Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. I have the pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Rita D. Sharma. She's a director and associate professor at the Meera and Ajay Shingal Center for Dharma Studies. And she's chair at the Department of Theology and Ethics at the Graduate Theological Union. Rita, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure. We're talking about a really, really rich publication, Contemplative Studies in Hinduism, Meditation, Devotion, Prayer, and Worship. And it's hot off the presses, isn't it? It's brand new.
Yes, it's hot off the press. Just came out.
It came out. In fact, the publication year is 2021 officially. So, yep, it's definitely brand new. Tell us a bit about the genesis of this collection. How did this come about?
Well, the genesis of the collection is rooted in organization, that is a scholarly society, which I co-founded, called the Dharma Academy of North America, because we were tired of scholars having no place to discuss the issues on Hindu Dharma that were of interest to us, which is ethics, philosophy, art, aesthetics, contemplative studies, cognitive studies, and so forth. Much of the work that was being done at this time, this is about 18 years ago when I first came out, I was still a graduate student. And I was so irritated with the fact that the work that I was doing had no space, no academic, no scholarly, no intellectual space to present it, that I co-founded Dharma Academy of North America. And as you may have noticed in the book, our acknowledgments are all to that. So the Dharma Academy of North America, better known as DANAM, acronym meaning gift, as you know, in Sanskrit. And it's the gift of a new engagement with Hindu theology, philosophy, ethics, spirituality, meditation traditions, yoga, and so forth. And not just what grandma is doing under the full moon in a remote village in somewhere in the Northeast. With all respect to grandmas, and I love my Naniji too, but we need to look beyond ethnography and into the tradition's core principles and practices and doctrines and ask, what does this mean? What does it mean beyond just customs and traditions? So that's when we decided to do a series of mini conferences, symposia, on the idea of Hindu practices being part of the field. The field is known, new field, not that new, I mean, it's about 20 plus years old, known as contemplative studies. And contemplative studies tends to focus on Christianity and Buddhism, and not all of Buddhism, just basically mindfulness, what, you know, in John Kabat-Zinn's version of insight meditation. And mindfulness is also a reductionist form of Vipassana. So that's, you know, that's a very narrow engagement with the massive traditions of contemplative life in the Dharmic traditions as a whole, Hinduism, Jainism, and Buddhism, but it's a complete denial of the presence of, not the presence, the centrality of practices of spiritual interiority, contemplation, reflection, insight in the Hindu tradition. So when we were done with these new symposia, we decided to do an edited volume and do a contribution. It's the first of three. The second is already started on contemplative practices, on contemplative studies in Jainism. But this one is groundbreaking because what we do here is that all of the things that even Hindus tend to think are meaningless, the word ritual is usually accompanied by the word meaningless when you talk to many South Asians of Hindu heritage, you know? And the thing is, it is of course meaningless if you don't know the meaning. And when you know the meaning, then you understand that it is a path to interior development.
So this space in Dhanam, let's talk a little bit about that, and we'll talk about maybe what is contemplative studies and how it relates to Hinduism. But so do you find that since this space was created, are there other spaces where you can do this sort of approach, or is it still fairly disparate or distinct from elsewhere at the Academy?
It's still a unique space that allows the voice of the scholar practitioner to be heard, and that we don't have to cover our voices with a false veil of a kind of a fake objectivity. The famous philosopher, German philosopher Gadamer, who I am very fond of, made this very clear that there is no intellectual capacity for the human mind to assess, examine, explore things without prior conditioning coming into interference with it. So if I am looking at a phenomenon in which I didn't grow up, in which I wasn't immersed, in which I don't fully understand, or towards which I have a bias because of conditioning, then I can claim to be objective, but it's really a denial of my inability to be objective as a human being. So it's much better, as Gadamer explained to us, to be aware of our prejudgments, to be aware of it, and to allow ourselves to be transformed by the encounter with the other.
What would you say about this distinction, perhaps useful, perhaps misguided, of edic and emic, this distinction of studying a religion from without versus within, and of course the two are intertwined. But would you say then that Dhanam, that it somehow prioritizes or leaves space for the emic paradigm? Or how would you, can you comment on that distinction in this space?
No, Dhanam does not prioritize, Dhanam does not leave out the Indic perspective, the external perspective. What Dhanam requires is that you engage the concept of meaning in the tradition, that your scholarship is not purely descriptive. And descriptive meaning, obviously we have to describe everything we encounter, but we don't stop at that because we should not stop at that because we're not journalists. Secondly, when you are describing scholarship, that this is anthropology, this is sociology of religion, psychology of religion, psychoanalysis, all of these Western frameworks, are projected on that which you are describing. And therefore, lenses are being projected onto a tradition or civilization or culture or society for which these lenses were not made. So you're wearing glasses, Raj, and if I put on your glasses, I mean, your glasses work very well for you, but if I put them on, I'm going to see a distorted world. So what Dhanam seeks is that whoever you are, take your glasses off and try to put the glasses on that belong to the world you're studying. So that go in there and try to bracket out your preconceptions, pocket them for the moment so that you can actually immerse yourself in the self-understanding of the people and the culture in which you are immersed in study.
Yeah, there's. I think I've talked about this tension on this podcast before. It's a fascinating one. I've recently been introduced to this teaching space at the Oxford Center of Hindu Studies, and it's very interesting. It's ultimately an Edic outsider perspective. It's ultimately an academic description of religion perspective, but it nevertheless goes out of its way, and sensibly so, in my view, to include the perspective of the practitioner, to understand, you know, we have folks who come there for a Hindu philosophy class from an intellectual perspective, and they find that they're actually changed by engaging in the ideas of Advaita or Sankhya or what have you. And the idea that the darshan, it's a worldview. It's so difficult to put the data and the minutiae of South Asian civilization into a worldview that is not of that civilization. And so entirely what resonates is, for example, taking cues from the tradition in terms of how to look at a text. For example, you may be looking at it through the lens of pravritti dharma versus nivritti dharma or whatever it is. So this fertile soil of Dhanam, you've talked about this. We'll get to the specifics about what's happening in the book, but tell us about contemplative studies. Like, what is that? You mentioned earlier it's a roughly 20-year-old field, but what is contemplative studies?
So contemplative studies is essentially the study of practices within religions, and now some of them have flown out of the religion in which they emerged and are being used in a secular context, such as mindfulness, which is actually insight meditation, which is actually Vipassana. And Vipassana is coming out of the Theravada tradition, but it certainly does not capture the entirety of that tradition. So contemplative studies looks at meditation, mainly meditation, and other practices of interiority that take you within yourself and that take your focus off the external and puts your focus on, I won't say the transcendent because we have to include Buddhism and Confucianism and Jainism and so forth. I would say that puts your focus on ultimate reality, however conceived. So if you're Christian, that would mean God. If you're Buddhist, it would mean maybe Pratitya Samudpada, to understand the meaning of anitya or impermanence. And in the Hindu case, it depends on your sampradaya, on your particular darshan.
So then this book, then this rich interlacing of what we may think of contemplative practices in Hinduism, what are the kinds of things that the book is showcasing? What would be considered contemplative practices in Hinduism?
So normatively, contemplative practices, because it was developed out of Christianity, which is fine, tends to focus on Christian forms of contemplation, Christian forms of meditation, and so on. And particularly Catholic, actually, because my Protestant colleagues say, well, no, there's no contemplative studies in Protestantism. I would actually disagree with them, because intensive prayer is a contemplative practice. So coming into Hinduism, the question is, what is meditation? And what is meditation in the context of Hinduism? So when you are meditating on your breath, or when you are chanting a prayer, then Christian contemplative practice, or the contemplative studies that have arisen out of Christianity and Buddhism, to a minor extent, would say, yes, that's contemplative practice. But Hindu meditation, the book argues that when we do puja, when we do sadhana of any sort, japa, when we do Akhanda Ramayana, Akhanda Gita, pat, all of this is meditation. Because when you're doing this, your mind is meant to be completely focused on that object of your meditation. When we do our personal rituals, for example, Pushti Marg is a Hindu Vaishnav denomination that gives primacy to the worship of Sri Krishna when he was in his childhood, and the method of engagement with that moment of his life is to take on Vatsalya Bhava, in other words, the mood of the mother of Yashoda. But the thing is that when this is done, I've interviewed women, Hindu women who do the practices of this tradition, and their children or grandchildren will laugh at them and say, you're playing with dolls. I also play with Barbie, you know. No, they're not playing with dolls. What they are doing is they're immersing their consciousness in Vrindavan. They're immersing their consciousness in a transcendent space and time. They are, through their imagination and through those practices of engagement with the Murti and engagement with the materiality of the puja, of the ritual of dressing and bathing and changing and feeding the Murti, they are in engagement through imagination with Krishna in his transcendent state in Vrindavan. So what I say is that the use of art in Hinduism, the use of the narratives of the Puranas through art, through dance, through drama, through music, through these ritual practices, takes us into that luminous and numinous space-time that exists beyond the temporal. And therefore, it is a contemplative practice of interiority.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Oh, just for the sake of, you know, engagement and respectful discussion, what would you say if someone said, you know, Rita, that's a really fascinating insight that there's something contemplative, necessarily contemplative, about the act of puja, about japa, about all of these various religious activities? What would you say if someone said, well, you know, it takes a certain kind of person. They might be more imaginative or intellectual or spiritual who would even envision or engage that dimension. And many folks may, you know, place the item there in the ritual and they're operating on the level of just the action. What would you say about that?
There's two answers to this question. The first one is that any practice, whether it's Christian, Muslim, Hindu, whatever, any practice, the effectiveness of that practice depends on the mood and attitude of the practitioner. So if the practitioner is really thinking about how the Dow Jones is not where he wants it to be today, or how his daughter is, you know, giving him worries because she's living in a state with a lot of fires. I mean, if the person is distracted, if the person is doing it mechanically because it's out of superstition, because the you know, tradition says you should do this or bad things will happen, then it's not a contemplative practice. It is only a contemplative practice when the individual practitioner really allows the practice to transform their consciousness and awareness during that time of practice. Now, that does not require a degree. That does not require even literacy, but it does require, if it were in the Advaita, it's called mumukshutva, but you can also call it chitti shakti. The Buddhists call it the bodhicitta. You know, all of these are ways of trying to describe the emergence of a determination to know the transcendent, to know the divine, to know the supreme. And I have seen village grandmothers who have this capacity more than people who are, you know, MD, PhDs. So it depends on the attitude of mind.
Yeah, that's a fascinating answer. There's much I'd like to respond to that, but for now we'll sort of keep it focused on the book. The book is organized in four parts, I believe. Yes, four. Tell us about the different parts and maybe why it's organized in the way it is.
The book is organized in these ways because, you know, there were many ways you can organize this. But we decided to organize it in this particular way because of the contributions that we received pretty much fell into these categories. So I would say that let me think about each of the four parts. The first part is a very simple conception, that is that what we're looking at is trans-religious and cross-cultural. So basically, there are two articles in the first part. The first one is by Professor Andrew Fort. It's called On Creating a Contemplative Studies Program in the Southwest, United States. And the second chapter in part one is mine. My chapter on this, other than my introductory reflections, is called Contemplative Experience and Inter-Dharma Comparative Reflection. Now, what I'm doing here is I'm showing the convergences and divergences between Hindu, Jain, and Buddhist contemplative praxis, and where we might have the same practices, but the telos or ultimate aim of the practice is very different. So it's an inter-dharma dialogue through this chapter. So the title of the first chapter is Contemplative Practices, Cross-Cultural and Interreligious Considerations. And Andrew Ford's chapter talks about those interreligious and cross-cultural considerations when he's developing this contemplative studies program in the Southwest United States and basically a Christian oriented institution. Then the second part, so we wanted to just frame the conversation in a broader context. The second part is called contemplation and yoga praxis. I always joke in my Yoga Foundations class, and I used to teach at USC, University of Southern California in Los Angeles, and I'm also now at Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. I always say the same thing, that yoga is about love and liberation. The leotards are recommended, not required. So the idea is that what is love and liberation? It's bhakti and it's mukti. So yoga is about bhakti and mukti, and contemplative yoga praxis is about the question of bhakti and mukti. So there's three chapters in this section, and the first one is on the concept of Ishvara Pranidhana, which is a strangely controversial subject in academics. You have Hindu scholar practitioners, very famous ones, like Canadian professor who has recently retired, T.S. Rukmini, who agrees with some of her other Western and Indian colleagues that the Ishvara of the Yoga Sutra and of Sankhya is really not an Ishvara as we understand it. It's not Bhagavan, it is not Saguna Brahman. It's really, in a way, the self, the Supreme Purusha, in other words, something you emulate. And then you have the Vaishnava tradition of Bhashya, or on the Yoga Sutra, commentary on the Yoga Sutra, which absolutely disagrees with that. And they see Ishvara as Bhagavan, as Saguna Brahman. So the second chapter in the part two, contemplation and yoga praxis, is called Emotional and Devotional Union, a Bhagavata Theology of Oneness. This is coming from the Krishna Bhakti tradition, and it's by Gopal Gupta. This is a very interesting concept. The idea in bhakti that the divine can be accessed through our emotions. And that devotion really is a form of love here. And that a loving, emotional attitude towards the divine allows us to transcend our conditioned consciousness and experience the grace and love of the Lord, of Bhagavan. The third chapter in this section is Sri Chinmoy on the nature and goals of contemplative practice. Sri Chinmoy is, of course, a modern guru who spent a lot of time in the United States. It's written by a professor Kusumita Peterson, who happened to be his direct disciple. So she's very familiar with his work and editing his work. And it's very interesting to have a kind of Advaitic, Vedantic approach to the concept of the nature and goals of contemplative practice. And then the third part is on sadhana. Sadhana as wonder, as knowledge, as love. So the first one is about Advaita Vedanta and the role of sadhana in Advaita Vedanta. People think of Advaita Vedanta as very rational, very logical, but Advaita Vedanta has very strong practices of sadhana. And we can talk about sadhana a little later. And then the second article is on the instability of non-dual knowing. Post-gnosis sadhana in Vidyaranya's Advaita Vedanta by Professor James Madeo. This is very interesting. There's a conception that even if you achieve Nirvikalpa Samadhi, even if you achieve the full existential self-realization of your true nature, in other words, you have full knowledge of Brahman, even being a Brahmavadin, you are embodied, and therefore your knowledge has to be nurtured, nourished, and cultivated so that it does not, you know, become unstable. The thing is that it's interesting. It reminds me of a book by Jack Kornfield, a book that has not received much attention. And the name of the book, Jack Kornfield is, of course, one of the founders of Insight Meditation. And Jack Kornfield's book is called After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. In other words, that ecstasy doesn't stay, that the gnosis of non-dual knowing doesn't stay, and then we have to come back to our lives. Well, the practices, the post-gnosis practices in Advaita Vedanta allow for the retention of the knowledge, for the stabilization of that knowledge, of that knowing. You know, it's transcendent knowledge, so that's why the word gnosis is used. And then the third article is Sri Vidya Shakta, model of esoteric sadhana of the Sri Chakra. So this is coming out of tantric Shaktism, and the meditation on the Sri Chakra is an esoteric practice. All those Sri Chakras everywhere, you know, every Hindu grocery store seems to have one, but the meditation on that is coming out of Tantra is what I would call the Shukshma meditation. And I categorize all Hindu practices, principles, and phenomena into three levels of approach. One is external, one is internal, and one is esoteric in English. And by external, I don't mean etic, that is an outsider studying it. I mean, even a Hindu doing it without proper knowledge and proper training. And in Sanskrit, I would say this is a stula, a gross, shukshma, subtle, and guha, or secret, esoteric. These are the levels of engagement with any of our practices and principles. The final, the fourth article in this section on sadhana is The Body and Wonder in Tantra by Lorelei Bernecki. And it's very interesting because the Tantra is very interested in embodied practice. And there's a misunderstanding in large parts of the Hindu community, not to mention the Western world, about what Tantra is, but better scholarship on Tantra is clarifying what it is, and Tantra has influenced all of Hinduism, and you can find Tantric elements way back in, say, the Vedas, in the Atharva Veda and other parts. And then the final article in this section, the final chapter, is Semiotics and Elocution in Gauriya Vaishnava Sadhana. And there's a lot to be said about that. Gauriya Vaishnava Sadhana is very complex, and it's in the West, you know, it's called Hare Krishna, which is very rude. It's like calling Christianity the Hallelujahs, you know, or calling Muslims the Allahu Akbars, you know, because Hare Krishna is a Maha Mantra for the Gauriya Vaishnavas. It's a half a millennia old tradition. And the tradition has developed the first comprehensive psychology of emotions to alter our consciousness. It's something worth studying. And then the last section, the fourth section, is called Prayer, Worship, and Ritual. And the first part of that is written by Professor Ramdas Lam of Hawaii, University of Hawaii. Well, Professor Ramdas Lam has titled his article, his chapter, Prayer and Worship in the Ascetics of the Ramanandi Sampradaya. Okay, so Ramanandi Sampradaya is one of the largest sampradayas, especially in North India. And Professor Ramdas Lam was a sadhu of the Ramananda Sampradaya for almost a decade. And, you know, he roamed in, you know, in those clothes, in bare feet, and he's very familiar what prayer and worship means in that context of being a true yogi, being an ascetic, the ascetic tradition. And Purushottama Velimoriya's next chapter is on the idea of mantric effect of effervescent devatas, noetic supplications, and apurva in the Mimamsa, in the Purva Mimamsa. And the final chapter is on prayer and worship through music and liturgy in the Vaishnava traditions of North India. So, you know, you have here a very, very rich and large plate of practices and sampradayas and traditions to look at for this book. And one of the things that I mention in my introduction is that when you bring in variety and variegation in terms of your, in terms of one specific tradition, in this case, Hinduism, what you're actually doing is you are diversifying the entire field of contemplative studies, because you're avoiding the essentialism that has crept into this very important field, which looks at human endeavor to be in touch with the divine, to be in touch with the ultimate.
Certainly a rich, rich array of contributions in their own right. And together they really, they sort of, well, at very least, perhaps expand the boundaries of what we think of as contemplative studies, not only in terms of including the Hindu world, but also in terms of what one might think of as a contemplative practice. So it's this volume is doing a lot, isn't it? What would you say, what are the subfields implicated? And what do you think the volume does for scholarship?
Well, so this volume marks the very first wide-ranging and multivocal academic survey of the major types and categories of Hindu contemplative practices. And as I said, from a breadth of scholarly viewpoints, they reflect both the variety, the variegation, the diversity in types of contemplative practices within Hinduism. And they also use the Hindu internal hermeneutical perspectives, the internal lenses, what we were talking about earlier, for expanding the concept of contemplation beyond definitions that, though incrementally being enriched by content from Buddhism, are still normatively constrained by Christian understandings of this concept. So part of the reason that the field remains fairly unrepresentative of the breadth of religious lives, let's say across cultures, lies in the lack of this kind of academic work from scholars of diverse religions on the subject of contemplative studies within their tradition. So when we started, I was first about to write a book on contemplative studies in Hinduism, and then I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I want to include these diverse voices because you will have depth in each of those chapters. And so that's why I started that series of symposia. And then contemplative studies as a discipline, it can be approached via several avenues. You can approach it by a rigorous focus on religious practices of contemplation, their history, their function within the context of one or more traditions, spiritual traditions. The second way is that the secular and interdisciplinary field of the study and the application of contemplative practice and experience. And this might include methods extracted from religions or developed in engagements with other areas of inquiry, like art and aesthetics and so on and so forth. And the third way is the neuroscientific approach that analyzes the effects of contemplation and tries to tell us that it's really, you know, what the neurobiological neuroscientific approaches are very interesting because they have studied things as diverse as transcendental meditation, Catholic prayer, Buddhist mindfulness practices, and so on. And they're finding that the consciousness itself is affected by these practices. So I had recently posted on social media an article from the National Institutes of Health in the United States that talks about the necessity for neuroscience to rethink what consciousness is because of the studies coming out of the neuroscientific study of contemplation. And then the fourth issue out of exploring these things is study and therapeutic application in the health sciences. As you know, mindfulness now is being used in all manner of health science fields. The problem with it, however, is that, you know, the problem of reductionism and essentialism, erasure of origins, deracination, cutting it off from its roots, and finally, perhaps distortion. So there's a danger in that, but at the same time, you know, if there's therapeutic applications and you're a physician, you might want to, you know, look at that. So finally, there are many programs, and in fact, I'm working on a project which is looking into development of a program which is transdisciplinary. It's called transdisciplinary research methodology. That is, it's not interdisciplinary. You're going beyond the disciplines to look at this a fascinating phenomenon, and it integrates psychology, social sciences, neurobiology, organizational applications, social science, you know, a wide array, not to mention philosophy, theology, ethics, and so forth. But, you know, whichever way contemplative studies is approached, it makes space for direct personal experience with specific forms of practice. And in this way, it challenges the denial of embodied experience and subjectivity within much of not just academic discourse, but scientific discourse. And it brings the issue of religious adherence in religious studies into higher relief. So, you know, this is what we're trying to do, that the Hindu world of contemplative praxis also offers all of these elements that we spoke about, such as the numerous forms and types of personal daily prayers, vocal prayer, meditation, contemplative prayer, liturgy, meditation in terms of breath, focusing on breath or focusing on mantra. But beyond that, I think what is more important is that the aim of our volume is to broaden our lens on the concept of contemplation by introducing the very, very rich culture of meditative communion, devotion, and spiritual development and formation, and psychology of emotion within the Hindu ethos, with its variegation and expansive, you know, four millennia-old history of deliberation on what constitutes meditative practices and why. What is meditative practice and why is it so? And so the first question that comes to mind for this book is, what makes a religious act a contemplative act? And contemplative practice is a shared category, you know, across many traditions. But the idea here is that, is it a practice that transforms awareness? Is it a practice in the Hindu world? You know, these are the questions one asks, is it a practice that creates a continuity between human life and the supreme reality, however conceived? So the, you know, we are trying to do a lot of things, and I would venture to say that contemplative praxis is one of the sacred threads that weaves through the Hindu world's very rich multiplicity and creates coherence and consistency. Because, you know, I'm going to give you a very brief story of the importance of that. And this forms in this contemplative praxis, which is like this sacred thread of coherence and consistency throughout the Hindu tradition, it forms the connective tissue that knits together not only religious practice as common ground, but also, I would say, the shared conception of the plane of narrative theology. Now, what do I mean by narrative theology? I am talking about the Puranas. The Puranas are diminished by Western scholarship for 200 years as mythology, and Hindus have internalized that. These are fairy tales, they say. Why should we look at fairy tales? Well, they're not fairy tales. They're very complex parables and narrative theology, and they are meant to be experienced through aesthetic, dramatic, performative action in transcendent space-time, or transcendent time, as I say, and imagined space. And this collective understanding is expressed aesthetically through the visual and material culture of contemplative worship. And it's perceived through sacred sound, shabda, sankirtana, mantra, and towards an evocation of very intricate intimacy with the divine. These sanctified expressions invoke for us Hindus the celestial within the terrestrial and can emerge with as much intensity, as I told you earlier, under a village tree as within the carved and sculpted halls of a temple. This is the reason that contemplative practice, whether liturgical or any other means, visual, individual, communal, has a central position in all the traditions within and those informed by Hinduism.
That was well said. There's a lot there. One quick note I'll make, I can't resist, otherwise I would comment on a number of things, from misperceptions of Tantra to, you name it, to the Chinmoy movement, which I used to frequent their Toronto restaurant, Annapurna, to all kinds of intrigues. James's paper is quite fascinating. Okay, you're awake in a body. How do you stay awake and not go back to sleep by duality? But the one thing I have to touch upon, I can't resist, is the power of narrative. Being a scholar of Purana, epic narrative, Sanskrit narrative, and just a lover of narrative in general, I started off as an English major, actually. And there's extraordinary power. There's a narrative text, a mythological, quote unquote, mythological text or a sacred lore or even a great work of literature. There is deep, profound, transformative power. Like, one can understand their lived experience more crisply, sharply, just through the power of this, quote unquote, imaginative work. You know, the story of the Devi Mahatmya, the disenfranchised king and the merchant who find the sage. And I mean, it goes on and on and on. And in the modern world, if we allow ourselves to relax into a sci-fi fantasy blockbuster, we may actually have some sort of experience, you know. But outside of that context, we really have trouble engaging the power of narrative because of the myth, small m, that it is a myth.
Yes. See?
Yes, and then what that means.
Therefore of no significance.
Yes.
But you know, what's interesting is that the narratives of the Hebrew Bible, the narratives of the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, and so forth, these are not called mythology, although if you look at it objectively, you have a Garden of Eden, which is obviously celestial. You have God creating Adam and Eve in what is definitely not supported by evolutionary science. And you have all of these things, but this is not myth. This is theology. But the Hindu narratives are myth. This comes out of the colonial context. And I'm right now teaching a class called Postcolonialism, Decoloniality, and Dharma, a dialogue. And in this class, it's really a critique of postcolonialism, because we suggest that postcolonialism states that there is a post-colonialism. Well, there isn't. There's only a new colonialism. I think almost every thinking Hindu has heard of this term, Brown Englishman, created by, I believe, Lord Macaulay, one of the governors of India. It's so brilliant. It's so brilliant. Let us train these colonized people to be thoroughly informed by our culture, to be so thoroughly informed by our culture that they differ from us only in their external appearance. Otherwise, they are us. And the brilliance of this is misunderstood. The post-colonialists think that it's over, but their very work proves that it's not over. The colonialist leaves, the colonialized mind remains. And to decolonize our minds is to seek epistemic justice. We right now, every colonized region, continent, nation on earth, and India is one of the largest nations that was actually colonized in terms of a civilization being colonized, one of the largest and most diverse. And what we have done is we have become Macaulay's very nice brown Englishman. And we have very little respect for our culture, our civilization, our religious culture, our spiritual culture, the 4 millennia of civilization, that there's nothing valuable there. Now, the problem is those who think that there's value there tend to do pseudoscience, tend to put value from contemporary present day ideas and project it onto the past, which is presentism. This is not the way to value the knowledge systems of a civilization, of a spiritual culture. The way to do it is to understand it on its own terms. What is it trying to achieve? And understand that it's not trying to achieve, a contemporary STEM and neurobiology. No, it is trying to achieve something very different. And that very different epistemology, valid means of knowing, and the product of that knowing stands as a prophetic corrective to our current crises. And this is what is not being either noted or understood by people who either remain in colonized minds or people who are trying to decolonize themselves by whitewashing the entirety of Hindu history as basically Western science rewritten.
I take your point definitely. And for my rather at times too universalistic mind, seems to me the problem is, this is a very important, unique series of problems you present for Indian civilization more generally. It seems to me that on the globe, the problem is even broader in that it's so difficult in this modern sort of Western global village that we find ourselves in. It's difficult to navigate and steer clear of fundamentalism, charlatanism, sort of unfounded beliefs and find a path that whereby one can reclaim the spiritual value of a religious tradition, one's own or even another's. And this to me is the problem of this epoch. You know, all of these ideologies are thrown into the wash cycle together, and we have this dominant narrative of materialism. And this is a huge challenge. And certainly, perhaps it's nowhere more colorly expressed than through modern engagement with Indian religion. It's been delightful chatting with you. Just one very quick question before I leave you for the day. You mentioned this is part of a series, but so what are you working on now? The second volume of this, or is there another project during?
Yes. So our second volume in the series should be out by the end of next year, I hope. We have all the chapters, and it seems like a wonderful volume. It's called Contemplative Studies in Jainism. Now, the interesting thing is that our book, this book, is called Contemplative Studies and Hinduism, but the subtitle is important because what we're doing with the subtitle is that we are bringing in prayer, worship, devotion, and of course, meditation. And we are using the same subtitle for our Jain volume in order to point to the fact that these Dharma traditions have, are different religions now, yes, but they have shared histories and they have shared practices, and yet their aims and purposes of the same practices, as I mentioned, are distinct. And that's fascinating.
This is absolutely fascinating. Well, thank you very much. We've been speaking today with Dr. Rita D. Sharma, who is Director and Associate Professor at the Mira and Ajay Shingle Center for Dharma Studies. She's also Chair at the Department of Theology and Ethics at the Graduate Theological Union. And of course, we've been talking about this brand spanking new publication, Contemplative Studies in Hinduism, Meditation, Devotion, Prayer, and Worship. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
It's been a delight. Thank you so much, Reg.
My pleasure. Until next time, out there, stay safe, number one. Number two, keep listening. Number three, keep reading. And perhaps number four, maybe contemplate this idea of contemplative studies in Hinduism. And maybe the next time you engage some sort of ritual, whether mundane or sacred, maybe add some awareness. Maybe think of it differently, relate to it differently. Take care.